Saturday, and I guess the third full day of session, and the last full day of session. And I guess in terms of sessions are normally about 7 days. And when at Zen Mountain Centre, we would start on a Sunday night, and then finish basically on a Sunday lunchtime, just after Sunday lunchtime. So it's almost a full 7, 6 and 3/4. And never quite got to 7 days here. We started off with 3 and then went to 4, and now it's kind of starting on a Wednesday. And I don't know if there's a science to sessions. I tend to approach it in terms of like the reason we come along to do a retreat is to, I guess, to get something out of it. And at ZMC we used to do month-long sessions as well, which were, they're basically like 4-week sessions back-to-back. We had like a half day between each new session, where we did a bit of laundry and had a hamburger. And then straight back into session again. And it's a different experience when you're living in a training centre, because it becomes kind of normal life to a certain extent. And I've really noticed the move coming out of a training centre and then coming into session, how the it's just palpably different, you know, that because you've come from a place of work or study or regular life, and then you come into this place and everything's very, very different. It's quite a shift. And it's almost like, but when you've been doing, if that kind of practices your life, then to get the same shift, you kind of need more. If you know, it's kind of like getting a certain resistance to a drug. Not quite right, but you know, has that certain feeling. So when we start off doing a month-long session, it kind of be that feeling you had to pace yourself a little bit, because you know, you kind of looked ahead and said 30 days till the end. That I burn myself up now by staying up late and twisting my body into pretzel. I'm not gonna last very long. But a different appreciation arises too. But anyway, this length of time, I think, is quite, maybe another extra day. It's hard to experiment, you know, to see what would be the best outcome. But it's a reasonable length of time to kind of settle down, and also something that is actually attainable in terms of, it's pretty hard for, I think, most people to take 2 full weeks off a year to do a session, but 2 half weeks, especially for me, is doable, and it seems to provide enough of that shift to be able to allow yourself to settle down and to appreciate a different way of seeing. So, and you know, as I mentioned earlier on too, this session is a Rahatsu session, our year end, and the one that commemorates the awakening of the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, who apparently, I just read, they're kind of redating his birth date now to another 100 years before 563. We're not sure, but they kind of dug up the Bodhi tree. Or they found something underneath the Bodhi tree. It's like a new, some kind of new shrine that predated the Buddha, but had a lot of Buddhist elements in it. So they're arguing over whether that was, you know, that stuff was around prior to the Buddha or not. So interesting. And the Buddhists, you know, in competition with the Christians and the Muslims are going, yeah, we're even earlier than before. It had been 500 years before, you were 600. So anyway, so the commemoration of the Buddha's enlightenment is marked across the Zen world at this time, that time of December 8th. And you know, as an icon, the Buddha is very important, but I guess in Zen, it's just the way the tradition has evolved, that I guess the Buddha's sutras and the teachings are not as relied upon, and there are, you know, koans and etc. where the Buddha gets a pretty, you know, pretty bad rap. If I met the Buddha walking, what's it? If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill the Buddha. Okay, you know. There's also talk about, you know, meeting Buddha and cutting him up and feeding him to the dogs. these aren't really disrespectful. They are, you know, there are really ways of saying, like, if you think you'll find something outside of yourself or your direct experience, that you need to take that and let it go. And especially with the aspect of Buddha being held up as being something special or something godlike, then it's dealing with that attitude. Point I wanted to talk about today was that aspect of not knowing or no plan, and you know, we grow up. I certainly did. You know, I guess most of us have grown up in a Judeo-Christian society. I guess it'd probably be the same in a Buddhist society too, but there's a certain sense of someone or something, you know, taking care of us. And I guess if you don't have God, then it could be the government or the All Blacks or something. And someone's got the plan. You know, someone's watching out for us, or setting what the standards are. And we grow up as children with parents too, who set the standard for us and stand in that place. And so there's kind of a certain point when it comes to this in practice where we kind of need to take responsibility for ourselves. And that really marks the shift into maturity. But it's really, that kind of conditioning is quite deeply ingrained, that there is a something to attain, some kind of way to be. And in an overt form, you know, we might say it's a, in Christianity you'd say it'd be God or heaven, in Buddhism you might say it's enlightenment or some kind of perfection to attain. And I remember Dada Roshi would say, who's an abbot at Zen Mountain Monastery in New York, he would say, you've got to take responsibility for your life, responsibility for the whole catastrophe, to paraphrase Zorba the Greek. You know, and that responsibility is that you kind of realise that not only it's up to you, this is all you're making. And there's kind of no one out there who's going to save you. And actually, there's really no one out there who really cares, sadly enough. We care more about ourselves than anybody else, than I do. You know, even your parents or your loved ones or children or pets or whoever it is that you might think is watching out for you is going to die, and they've all got their own concerns as well. And so there's a certain aspect of solitariness. Sort of James K. Baxter says, we are born alone and die alone. Yet see the red gold cirrus over snow mountain shine. Lovely poem. And, but that kind of sense of vastness, that and so that sense of responsibility really is there, that yeah, you're given this life without a roadmap. Reminds me of when we were in Japan recently, is that we discovered when we got there, kind of had this plane, had a hotel, got off the plane, caught the subway into Shinjuku Station or whatever it was, and then had an address mistake in Japan. Addresses mean nothing. Mm-hmm. So I get off, it's like 8 o'clock at night, and so we had this address of this hotel. You go up to see, there's a map on the wall. But it's like one of those strange things about Japanese maps. I don't know where the history comes from, but a street name bears no relevance to the address that's written here bears no relevance to a map. And when you try and find the street names aren't marked either. So, and there's some kind of numbering system which I still haven't worked out, which I think is like when the building was constructed. Is the number. And you've got these huge so-called streets with so-called names. They haven't got names on them anyway. And then you're trying to find the number, and the number 100 could be there or it could be there, just depending on whether that was the 100th building to be built on the block. Why did I say that? Oh, that's right, no maps. So, and that kind of thing is like, you get this vast sense of unknowing, you're kind of a bit jet-lagged, get off a flight, no one talks English. You've got this map which is meaningless, and it's getting dark, and you don't have a clue. And but we were saved by the kindness of strangers, someone who did speak English, and walked us half a mile to our, because we got at the wrong stop anyway, to our hotel. But we encounter this life, and we find that there's no particular place to go. We don't know where we've come from, and we like to, we in a sense we want to cling to some kind of direction, that there is a map, that there is a way to go, and we can see ourselves doing this all the time. You know, we'll read the works of the teachers in the past. We'll try and plot a route to match someone else's example. And we may model ourselves on someone we admire, and then see whether ourselves match up to that particular person. You know, but the kind of raw fact is, you know, we come into this world naked, and we exit that way too. And in between is a strange experience that we're all involved in right now. And in Zen we call that not knowing. And that not knowing is, rather than just kind of duh, is a practice that we cultivate. And the reason we cultivate not knowing is, it's because the opposite of not knowing is knowing. In other words, having aligning ourselves with some kind of thoughts, ideas, concepts which don't match our direct experience. Now, Bodhidharma, who is the founder of Zen in China, came from, he was the son of a fun somebody, yeah, I'm sure. Anyway, and he was a Brahmin, and he I think he was royalty. They all seem to be royalty. Probably all wish they were royalty. Came out from China to India. No, from India to China. That's right. And so he's an Indian teacher. So he came out to China, and it took him a long, long time to get there. And the journey was very dangerous. And he met one of his first, when he arrived, Buddhism was already in China at that time. But he was, the story goes that he was known as a famous Buddhist master. And so he has an audience with Emperor Wu, who was the emperor of China at the time, very powerful. And it's those kind of, constantly read stories of people losing their heads all the time, you know, if you said the wrong thing. And Bodhidharma comes to meet the emperor, and the emperor has been supporting Buddhism for quite a while. He said to Bodhidharma, you know, I've ordained thousands of monks, I've built hundreds of temples, and what merit have I gained? You know, it just seems like a fairly straightforward kind of question. Bodhidharma just says, no merit whatsoever. And so the emperor is slightly taken aback by this, you know, kind of Indian foreigner. And then he says, okay, so what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? You know, what is the point of all this thing? Give me some Dharma, Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma says, vast emptiness, there's nothing holy. So the emperor's now taken back again. He wanted a bit of Dharma exposition. So what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? What is the most important thing? And Bodhidharma just says, there's nothing holy. There's nothing fixed. And the emperor is taken back again. So he's just like, well, who are you then, standing here before me? Bodhidharma says, I don't know. And the story has, he turns around and he heads across the Yangtze River and goes to a Shaolin monastery where he faces the wall for 9 years and goes into a cave. And the story goes on later that the Emperor Wu regrets their encounter with Bodhidharma, and he talks to one of his ministers and says, we should go after him and get him back. And the minister Shi says, You know, even if you sent the whole of China after him, he wouldn't turn around. And it kind of goes on further to say, before he died, the emperor, you know, inscribed on a stone about his great regret as having missed that opportunity. But that koan has kind of come down to us today about, and that's the first case in the Blue Cliff record. And you know, it's Bodhidharma's not known that, who is this? Who are we, you know, sitting here? And it's like, I don't know. And that's kind of our question. It's like when we sit here, it's like, and when we walk around, you know, what is this thing? What's this lump of red flesh that sits here? And this not knowing is the antidote to that kind of fixed ideas about who we think we are, what we think life is. And the wonderful thing is that when you practice something like Sesshin, is that you directly encounter that. That it's you can't get away from the fact that, you know, you can't control this experience. You know, I describe that thing about trying to bob for apples. It's like when you try and focus in on breath or koan or the counting, is that, you know, you may get pretty good at it. But when you start drilling down into it further, there's kind of nothing you can you can really grasp. There's nothing solid you can hang on to. You know, the rain comes, the wind blows. You know, the world is just unexpected. Nothing goes to plan. And the way, and when we suffer, you know, our suffering is that because we think we know, or we think we have an expectation, and that's not matched up by our thoughts and ideas, and that gives us a real sense of suffering. And the reason we get that is because of that real attachment to thought and knowing. So when we sit, it's like that this beautiful practice that has been handed down to us means that we bring ourselves back to experience, you know, something that is tangible and touches us directly, and we align ourselves with that and let go of that knowing, let go of all that mental energy and contriving and almost habitual way of approaching our lives. And the challenge is to let that go and then just come back to this direct experience. It's like Dogen Zenji comments, he says, when you practice, you know, there's no one who said, "Oh, here's enlightenment, just as I expected it." And even that, we have ideas about what, you know, what peace looks like, what will be a satisfactory outcome for these 3 or 4 days. You know, I've certainly got that. So I think I've invested this amount of time. If I feel more than this, that's good. If I feel less than this, that won't be so good. Maybe I won't come next time. And it's quite unconscious, most of it. Just read something from the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, which is a fascicle from Dogen Zenji. It's a beautiful piece of writing. And here he kind of talks about what things that we may think are facts. In this case, he talks about water, using it as a bit of a metaphor. Just the way even all of us experience so-called facts in different ways. He says, "All beings do not see mountains and waters in the same way. Some beings see water as a jeweled ornament, but they do not regard jeweled ornaments as water. What in the human realm corresponds to their water? We only see their jeweled ornaments as water. Some beings see water as wondrous blossoms, but they do not use blossoms as water. Hungry ghosts see water as raging fire or pus and blood. Dragons see water as a palace or a pavilion. Some beings see water as the 7 treasures or a wish-granting jewel. Some beings see water as a forest or a wall. Some see it as the Dharma nature of pure liberation, the true human body, or as the form of body and essence of mind. Human beings see water as water. Water is seen as dead or alive depending on causes and conditions." That's kind of hungry ghosts see water as raging fire or pus and blood. Ugh. Dragons see it as a palace or a pavilion. And human beings see water as water. It says water is not blue, yellow, red, white or black. Water is not forms, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or mind objects. But water, as earth, water, fire, wind, and space, realizes itself. For this reason, it is difficult to say who is creating this land and palace right now, or how such things are being created. To say that the world is resting on the wheel of space or on the wheel of wind is not the truth of the self or the truth of others. Such a statement is based only on a small view. People speak this way because they think that it must be impossible to exist without having a place on which to rest. In a sense, you know, even sitting here, we kind of think that, okay, I can maybe be comfortable with this not knowing, but there is something out there. And Dogen Zenji kind of compassionately points out that that so-called water is also unfixed. Though that so-called concrete reality is also unfixed. So both the so-called subject and the so-called objects are all empty. That's why this practice can be a bit scary, you know. So all that stuff pulled out, but the only thing that's really being pulled out is the basic delusions. So yeah, it's kind of a not knowing is a practice. You know, it's its own koan. And not knowing just in a kind of a certain statement, but not knowing as a practice. And so how do we not know? You know, and so that's, again, in Sesshin we're provided with that opportunity of every action, whether it's sitting, walking, sleeping, eating, using the bathroom, is that every aspect of our day that we can let go of that kind of concept, that idea of that we know how things are going, except if you're the Tenzo or the Dao. we don't want to take that as license to just a free for all. To let go into that kind of that vastness. And we use these words kind of vastness and emptiness and you know, but it's quite simple. You know, it's manifest as, you know, the sound of the rain. But what is the true fact of that sound of the rain? You know, when we say the sound of the rain, there's a certain kind of separation and knowing about what rain is. But what is its essence? Yeah, so it's almost like a sweeping. You know, it's like constantly sweeping, sweeping, sweeping. I'll just finish with a poem by Rumi, which Sam mentioned yesterday in Dogsan, and Sonny, because I just read it as well. He mentioned it, and I'd read it half an hour before. That lovely poem by by Rumi about being open to all that comes, and again that being open to all that comes happens by letting go of the stuff that we know. The stuff that, gives us security. It says, this being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honourably. They may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Okay, we've got about one more day of Sesshin. So, you know, at this point, like, we have settled down a bit. The energy is good, and did you use this time well? It's my Dharma brothers would always say when he'd give a talk, he'd say, get your money's worth. You know, because we've committed time and energy to this period together. You know, so we use what's at hand and come back to this direct experience. Yeah, it's a gift that keeps on giving. All right, let's finish.